The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
You know, I would be a lot more comfortable this morning if I was sitting where you are sitting. I confess, though, that I have sort of secretly wanted to be up here, and Mark actually invited me in May. So this is a warning. Be careful of what you wish for. Our intentions are very powerful, aren't they? The title of my talk this morning is The Pearls and Perils of Buddhist Retreat Practice. A retreat is defined in the dictionary as this: to withdraw, to pull back, to take refuge, to go into seclusion. Retreats can range from a half a day to weeks and months and even years. Actually, the most important form of retreating is what we do every day if you have a daily sitting practice. To me, that's a retreat. You're retreating from the affairs, the petty concerns, the big concerns that rule your life, and you're dropping into, you're dropping from the head into the heart and into the body. And to me, that's the foundation of practice, and it's the most, your retreat will go nowhere if you don't have a daily practice. So that's probably the number one retreat that we do. It may be interesting, I thought, for us to find out who here has gone on a retreat. So let's start with somebody who has gone on either a half day or a full day at Common Ground. Can you raise your hand, please? That is at least half the room. How about a weekend retreat? And a week-long retreat? Wow, still a large number of people. And longer than a month or longer, raise your hand. Just four people. All right. And let's hear for some people from some people. Just shout out. I'll repeat for the microphone. We won't bother with the mic. Where did you go on the retreat? What was the purpose of your retreat? What were you looking for? Half day, full day, whatever. Why did you go on the retreat?
Deeper insight.
Deeper insight. To gain insight.
Deepening practice.
Deepening the practice, yes.
Quieting the mind.
Say more.
Transition.
Can you say more?
One life to another, changing life.
Yeah. Yeah. That helps us when we're going through major changes in our life to get away.
Reflection.
Yes, to reflect. Yes.
Curiosity.
Curiosity and stillness. Good.
Transform suffering.
Transform suffering. Good. Great. All right. In one of the most famous and important suttas in our tradition, known as the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha highlights the importance of going on retreat. Although I don't think that concept of going on a retreat is, I think it's just seclusion. But anyway, I would like to read from the Satipatthana Sutta. This is from a book by Venerable Analeo, who was a German monk, author, meditator, prolific scholar who is alive now. So reading from this is just the translation here that he has at the beginning of his book. This is the Buddha. monks, this, the Satipatthana Sutta, is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for acquiring the true mind, the true method, for the realization of nibbana, namely, the four Satipatthanas. What are the four? Here, monks, in regard to the body, a monk abides contemplating the body, diligent, clearly knowing, and mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. So this sentence is repeating for the other three Satipatthanas, which are feelings, the mind, and the Dhammas. And how, monks, does one regard And how, monks, does one in regard to the body abide, contemplating the body? Here's the seclusion part, the retreat part. Here, gone to the forest, or to the root of the tree, or to an empty hut, one sits down, having folded their legs crosswise, set their body erect, and established mindfulness in front of themselves. Mindful, one breathes in. Mindful, one breathes out. So that's very powerful testimony to the importance the Buddha places on retreat. So I'm just going to go over the characteristics of a retreat for those of you who haven't been on a retreat. In order to create a retreat environment that's conducive to turning from outward orientation to inward orientation, there are guidelines in the Theravada tradition, which is our tradition. And we can create a container. And the first container is noble silence, that we keep silent, that we don't talk. The second one, in order to facilitate that, of course, all electronic devices are asked to be turned off. At the last retreat I was at, not the last one, but one of the retreats I was at, they actually had a ceremony where we all confiscated our phones. And we put our phones in envelopes. Restraint of the senses. And I have a new definition of the meaning of this since the last retreat, which was the most very powerful retreat, where they really went very deep. It was, you just don't look anywhere. You're like a horse with blinders. And the same for hearing. If you hear something, you just hear it, just a noise being known. You don't turn your head and look at somebody who just dropped something, or it was very, very powerful, this restraint of the senses. Usually on a retreat, you wake up very early. Some places you wake up at 3:30, some places 4:30. If you go out to prayer farm, it's 5 o'clock in the morning. And the day consists mostly of sitting and walking, and not much else except for meals and maybe a Dharma talk in the evening. If you're lucky, some retreats have Qigong or yoga. I really love those retreats because I think it's really important to honor our bodies. So I'd like to talk to you about my first retreat, which was at Plum Village in it's Thich Nhat Hanh's retreat center in France, and this was in 1993. And it was simply by accident that there was a book at the checkout counter, and the book said it was at Orr Books on Hennepin Avenue in South Minneapolis. It's now gone, but I was there, and there was this book called "Peace Is Every Step," and I just picked it up and read it, and it didn't make any sense at all. I sort of wanted to throw the book across the room. It just And I remember there was a phrase in there, wash the dishes, a definition of one of the working definitions of mindfulness is wash the dishes as if you were washing the baby Buddha. It just was completely, I was completely perplexed, but very intrigued. So I went to France. I was married to a French woman at the time, and I decided I'm going to go on this retreat. And I went, and it was life-changing. It was just very profound experience. They have this enormous bell, just tall and big, and they invite the bell to sing every 15 minutes all day long. And you can imagine what that does. It just interrupts this. We have this flow of thoughts and discursive thinking, and you hear this bell, and the instructions were to stop. You may be engaged in a conversation, you may be washing the dishes, whatever. You just stop, and you return back into your body, and you take some mindful inhalations, and you're aware of the sensations of the body as you're breathing in, and aware of the sensations of the body breathing out. And to me, that was it was transforming. I hesitate to call it a retreat, though, because it's sort of, it was in a different tradition. It's not the Theravada tradition, which we are from. It's the Mahayana tradition. And a lot of the definitions of retreat don't apply to this. For example, there wasn't a lot of restraint of the senses. There was a lot of talking. There were people from all over the world. And you were often engaged in fascinating and deep conversations, but even the tenor of the conversations was different. It wasn't like you never asked them what they did for a job. I mean, that's almost the first thing they would say, what do you do for a living here in America? But that would never be in the conversation. You would just go for the meat, you know, like the really important things in life. So it was sort of like a family camp. There were families there, and there was lots of eye contact, and they're singing. In fact, the song that we sing during the school year when we have the children's program, that song, Breathing In, Breathing Out, that comes from Plum Village. It was so powerful. I returned with my daughter when she was 1 year old. She's sitting here now this morning. She took her first steps there. And we returned again when she was 10 years old. The first time I went, I remember hugging somebody at the end, and I cried as I'm crying now, just because it was such a profound experience of peace that I had never tasted before, and I realized there is a path, and I want to take that path. I stayed on the path. I went to the Minnesota Zen Center, and I started practicing there for maybe 8 or 9 years, and then I came to Common Ground when they were in the old building in Mark's house. I retired as a school teacher 2 years ago, and then I realized I can start taking longer retreats. I didn't realize this was deliberate. I retired early so I could take some longer retreats and really pursue the practice. So the first thing I did was I had attended a Steve Armstrong retreat in Kamala Masters, and I decided I'm going to go to Burma, where Patrice Kwas has studied and Mark has studied and other people have studied from Common Ground. And I studied with Sayadaw Utejaniya. A hallmark of Tejaniya's style is relaxation. and which was really good for me because I'm sort of a type A striver perfectionist. And he's all about just chill. It's very powerful, and I'm just delighted that now Common Ground is referring to him and his books a lot. He avoids words like concentrate and focus. Rather, he uses words like recognize and just notice. Being on retreat, there are going to be lots and lots of challenges. You bring expectations. You know you're not supposed to have expectations, but you still bring them. Even we bring cultural expectations. For example, when I went there to Burma, I thought that a meditation place should be quiet. There were loudspeakers 24/7. It's in Yangon, and so there are loudspeakers all over. In fact, the meditation center has a loudspeaker, but also you hear the town loudspeakers, and they're blasting Asian pop songs, and occasionally you hear one in English, you know, and you might find yourself humming along to the Beatles or Creedence Clearwater Revival or an Asian version of that. And then occasionally there were glorious moments of silence where maybe early in the morning especially there was quiet. But and another thing is that all the Dharma talks were in Burmese, even though lots and lots of Western students flocked to Burma. All of the Dharma talks are in Burmese, and they're not translated. So there was a lot of aversion. And that was my task. That was my practice. Just, you know, it wasn't like I wasn't practicing calmness. There was no calmness. I was practicing anger, and this life is not going how I want. What's that about? What does that feel like? Where is that in my body? Does it go away? Is it constant? Or does it go away? Are you bothered by the thick smoke of burning leaves and plastic bottles burning in the courtyard once a day? Are you upset because life in Burma is life in Burma, it's not America, even though you got on the plane and went to a third world country? So what's important, Tejaniya says this, what's important is not the object of the concentration, it's not the loud person that's talking in the Dharma hall or the person on the cell phone in the Dharma hall. It's how are you relating to what's happening? What's your attitude of mind to the object? The mind is always aware. It's not the object. It's not the provocation. It's how are you relating to it? Can the mind become curious and interested? How is it that a second ago you were sitting there very peaceful and all of a sudden anger pops up? My most recent retreat was just last month. I spent a month at the Forest Refuge, which is in Massachusetts. The retreat was with Sayadaw Vivekananda, a German monk who served as a translator for one of the foremost meditation masters, Sayadaw Upandita, who died in April of 2016. The teaching style of Sayadaw Vivekananda could not have been more different than Tejaniya's. Opposite ends of the continuum. Tejaniya is relaxed. He even recommends lying down meditation. Whereas Vivekananda is sort of a relentless, precise noting, precise empirical observation that you're noting, aimed at revealing the fundamental, the underlying nature of the mind and the body. So that in It really is 24/7 mindfulness. No delineation and no breaks. And when there are breaks, you certainly are noticing them. So every moment of the day needs to be labeled. You're noting it. So if you're thirsty, then you notice desire. And you notice your arm just automatically almost reaching for the glass. You're stretching. You're intending to pick it up. You grasp it. You pinch it a little harder. I'm transferring it to your other hand. Thirst. You notice the thirst being the saliva coming, the anticipation, the touching of the lips. The swallowing, the weight of the glass, the smoothness, the texture of the glass. So, like Tejaniya, he does say continuity of mindfulness. Tejaniya is very big about continuity. And so is he. In order to accurately note everything, you have to go really, really slow. I have never seen such slowness in my life. Really. My friend Bob accompanied me on this retreat. And he was the master of slowness. He taught me. He was my model. And while you're doing this, of course, you're going to watch your mind. The mind does get very quiet, but also you notice things. You notice your thoughts, and you notice mind wanderings, and that's the fodder for practice. So the positive side of a retreat like that is that he sets a very high bar, and amazingly, you go for it, or at least I went for it, which you can probably think back to a teacher that you had that set a really high bar. And you just loved the teacher, and you loved what he or she was teaching in college or high school. And you lived up to it. And I did my best. I have never before experienced such peaceful sittings. Not to say that I also had some really rocky sittings. Most of them were rocky, but I have a new understanding of what mindfulness entails because it was so deep. There's a negative side to that sort of teaching too. And it really pushed my buttons. I felt like he was guiding us on this sort of game board, and he had a plan, and if you didn't follow his plan, then he would just nod and smile, but you clearly weren't saying the right thing. And I had a sort of a crash about 2 weeks in, because then I had the defilement of comparing mine. Oh, I'm not doing as good as somebody else. And comparing mine can be very invidious. And then you just watch that. That's really the object. It's not the suffering. Just watch the suffering. Watch this comparing mind. Comparing being known. Pain being known. Aversion being known. So that's one of the perils of meditation practice or of a retreat practice. Is this comparing mind, or it's often known as yogi mind. Your mind is quieting down, and you're bringing sort of a magnifying glass to the habits of the mind. And typically the habits of the mind are completely obscured to us because we just try to avoid, our modus operandi in daily life is to go for the pleasure and push away the painful things. And we distract ourselves by looking for pleasant things, which is why daily practice is so important. Another peril is gain-seeking mind. I've always worked really hard for, you know, I speak French, I speak Spanish. Well, those didn't come easily. I worked for them, and so, but it doesn't work when you bring that kind of mind to meditation. It actually backfires. It gives you a headache, and it gives you, produces lots of suffering. So going on a retreat poses a paradox, doesn't it? You want to deepen your practice, you go on a retreat, and when you get out there, you need to let go. You need to let go of your agenda. Because having goals introduces the idea that things aren't okay right now. And it produces tension. Ajahn Chah, one of the most respected and loved meditation masters of Thailand, who was instrumental in establishing Theravada in the West, actually. A lot of teachers that we studied with Ajahn Chah. He writes, "In the beginning, we practice with some desire in mind. We practice on and on, but we don't attain our desire. So we practice until we reach a point where we're practicing for no return. We're practicing in order to let go." And I can so relate to that, because I would strive and strive. I would get so frustrated that I wasn't getting anywhere, and so I would just give up. And guess what happened when I gave up? I would surge ahead if I just let go. So, continued the Ajahn Chah quote, I interrupted myself. So this is something we must see for ourselves. It's very deep. It's natural to want peace. We must practice without wanting anything at all. If we don't want anything at all, what will we get? We don't get anything. Whatever you get is a cause for suffering. So we practice not getting anything. The worldly way is to do things for a reason, to get some return. But in Buddhism, we do things without the idea of gaining anything. So I'm sure you've been waiting for the pearls. Right now I've probably done a good job of discouraging you from ever going on any retreat. So I didn't think about this until just a few days ago, think about a pearl. How is a pearl made? It's made around some irritant. So it's the pearl principle. No pain, no gain. So going on retreat, as somebody suggested when I was taking popcorn at the beginning, that it provides an occasion to put into practice, you know, what we've been studying, what we've been reading, and deepening our practice, is what somebody said this morning. We all know the health and wellness benefits of mindfulness. There was no research 30 years ago, and now there are tons and tons of scientific journals that attest to the benefits in health and in happiness for meditation. Another pearl is that you can live secluded from worldly ways like the noble ones. I'm going to skip over some things because I'm seeing we're running out of time. But I do want to say that going on retreat is excellent preparation for what's to come in our lives. I deliberately chose the five recollections to chant this morning. And that's what's to come. It was a very small retreat. They deliberately limited it to only 30 people. And there were several meditation teachers on the retreat, and one of them was Gregory Kramer. And I had the good fortune to be able to speak with him at the end of the retreat. And he said something that was very profound. He said, going on retreat, oh, I should preface this with saying that he's been battling cancer. He's been battling cancer for 2 years, and happily it went into remission, and he was able to go on the retreat. But he said, this is meditation, and this practice is the best preparation that we can do for sickness, old age, and death. It's the best preparation. So they're good preparation because we try to sort of avoid pain instead of look directly at it, right? We're looking for happiness in all the wrong places, and we're yanked around by our desires and by our aversions, and we fail to see what leads to true happiness, to unconditioned happiness. So, to wrap this up, I encourage you to consider going on a retreat. Mark often says it's the difference between reading a menu and actually ordering the food and sitting down and savoring it and tasting it. So typically there's some nugget. There's always something that I learn on a retreat, even if I really suffered a lot. And so I bring that back, and it gives me more motivation to practice. And so it's sort of, and then I always end up practicing more, and then I go on another retreat, and then I practice more. So I urge you to go on a retreat. We have the Common Ground newsletter that is announcing several upcoming retreats, half day, full day, and weekend retreats. And Common Ground has a retreat center now, so you could go out there. And I wanted to alert you to Liberation Park, which is in Wisconsin, very close by. I've never been, but I would like to go. And then there's Arrow River, which is just on the other side of the border, just due north. And that's a wonderful place. And by the way, our mind has lots of reasons and rationales not to go on retreat, but there But one of them shouldn't be money, because almost all the retreats are free. Well, that's not true. In the Theravadan tradition, they are free. For example, Arrow River, they're entirely free. So room and board is paid for. Obviously, people like to give back in dana, and we like to return. But the teachings are freely offered, and sometimes even room and board are freely offered. That is true in Asia as well. So, Tom, how much time do I have left? I wanted to leave 10 minutes for Q&A, but I wanted to share a few things that I learned. So I'll end with that. And then you can hit me up after. If we run out of time, you can stay after and ask me. But I wanted to share with you what I learned, at least some of the things. I went into report to Sayadaw Vivekananda one day, and I was struck by how much suffering I caused myself. It's just human nature to cause suffering for ourselves. And I just, it was just, you know, whatever the reason is, it's, you know, it's our fears, it's our projections, it's our anxieties. I caused a lot of suffering for myself preparing for this talk. I wrote 23 pages. My wonderful partner helped me edit them down to, I wrote, went from 14 to, excuse me, from 23 pages to 14. Kyoko said, 8 is what you need. I never got there. So that was a profound learning, is how much suffering I create for myself. I need to learn to get out of my own way. So I'm going to keep on going on retreats, I guess. I'm going to keep on practicing. Because we fabricate stories, dramas, often out of the slightest threads of information. My daughter doesn't return a text. It's late at night. I might worry about her. She's a young, responsible girl. She can take care of herself. She has her own life. I need to be responsible for mine. Vivekananda's response was spot on. He said, "We are our own best enemies." He's a German monk. I thought, is it best enemies or worst enemies? They both work. Yeah. And then he said, remember, it's not the object. It's how is the mind relating to this? How is the mind relating to this story? It's just a thought. It's just a perspective. It's just a facet of reality. It's not the truth. I don't have to believe what I think. We all know people who don't question what they think, right? It's dangerous when people believe their thoughts are right and everyone else is wrong. You may know of a politician right now who wreaks havoc in a lot of suffering by this way of thinking. It's typified by a bumper sticker I recently saw. I could switch my opinion and agree with you, but then we'd both be wrong. So that was the big learning. But there's another one. It's the same as Dorothy's in The Wizard of Oz. Did you figure it out? Thank you. Yes, there's no place like home. Really, there's no place like home in many, many different senses. First of all, it's wonderful to come back to my partner, and to my home, and to my family, to my daughter. There's so many luxuries in home and conveniences in home that you don't have on retreat. I remember the first morning waking up in my bed, and it felt so luxurious. Just the sheets and the softness of the bed. In Myanmar, in Burma, the mattress was that thick. About the same thickness, or a little less than the cushion you're sitting on. The second meaning of home is it's the number one place to practice. The faulty thinking is it's out there someplace with somebody else. It really is up to you to do the practice at home. Going to the bathroom, washing the dishes, walking into the study to print a document, picking up the phone, how you're relating to the people who live with you. And then home as in the context of being in the Twin Cities. We are so fortunate to live in the Twin Cities. There's so much good Dharma there. So many good people coming, teachers coming and going. And in my opinion, we have one of the very best meditation teachers in the country, Mark Nunberg. He's just He walks his talk. He has integrity. We're really lucky to be here. And I appreciate the fact that he's not a monk. I've lived with monks. I've driven monks to doctor appointments. I've lived at a monastery. But he's like a real person who's has a partner, and he has a house, and he has a cat, and he pays bills. And I can relate to that. All right. We had time for one question, or shall we? Two questions.
Actually, I'd like to say it's not really a question, but it's a thank you. I'm leaving for Spirit Rock on Friday.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
I'm going to be with Joseph. And
lovely.
My first thought was, I want to make sure I get to have an interview with him.
Yeah.
And after listening to you, I'm going, no. That, you know, I don't need to have that desire holding me back and keeping me, all of a sudden, my greed and my delusions of what this week, actually it's a 10-day, going to be like. And so I appreciate this sharing because I can take that with me. Thank you.
Great. Enjoy your retreats.
Thank you.
One more question over here.
Thanks, Rob. That reminded me of some of the experiences I've had on retreat, especially around the aversion because of all of the noise. And the key thing there is the aversion, because when I was at Spirit Rock, it was in the California spring, so it was still winter here, so it was a good place to be. And the frogs and then the turkeys walking around were making a lot of noise all the time. But one of the teachers made an announcement after the morning Dharma talk, and that was that, now if you folks want to take notes, please leave the meditation hall because people are complaining about the sound of your pencils on the paper. And I got so aversive to that, I wanted to stand up and say, well, excuse me, could you repeat that? I couldn't hear you over the frogs and the turkeys. So the aversion arises no matter what the circumstance, and it's a good thing to look for.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Everything is fodder for the practice, isn't it? All right. So may this practice be for the benefit of all beings, and may the blessings of this practice be shared with our parents and teachers, family and friends, and with all beings everywhere. May our lives join the great stream of causes and conditions leading to the awakening of all beings. May all beings be safe and protected. May all beings be happy and peaceful. And may all beings live with ease and joy and be free from the causes of suffering. Thank you for coming, everyone.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.